And a very warm welcome back to Solidarity Breakfast.
A left response to the major developments in capitalism.
What they trade in is not wheat. They trade in famine.
A little dose of revolutionary optimism.
I think it's really important to sort of express solidarity globally.
It really is a deal by corporations for corporations.
The union forever defending our rights. Down with the black leg.
If you think the ABC's left wing, don't listen to this program.
Solidarity Breakfast, 7:30 to 9 a.m. Saturdays, 3CR, 8:55 a.m. Streaming and 3CR digital, podcast or audio on demand. And of course, the website, solidaritybreakfast.org.au.
Solidarity forever!
Yeah, good morning. Saturday again. This time, I'm here behind the desk by my lonesome. Everyone's caught sick with the flu. Let this be a reminder for everyone to go and get your flu shot. It is that time of the season. I was a brave little banana this week and got my flu shot. Do it. Keep yourself safe. Keep people around you safe. But once again, you're here on Solidarity Breakfast, 3CR Community Radio. It's me, Tobia, for you this morning, Saturday, 10th of May. You can keep me company. Send an SMS to 0488 809 855 and see how today goes. I've written out some headlines in lieu of any partners, so bear with me while I try and be very, very, very professional. We have quite a few international headlines this week, starting with some developments from Palestine and surrounding territories. In Palestine, the situation continues to worsen as Israel continues its brutal campaign of destruction. Early in the morning last Friday, the 2nd of May, in international waters just off the coast of Malta, a humanitarian vessel dubbed the Conscience, a humanitarian boat part of the Freedom Flotilla and carrying aid and supplies, as well as 18 volunteers, among who, crazily, was Greta Thunberg, was attacked by drones. The ship, with human rights activists and humanitarian aid on board and on its way to Gaza, was struck in the bow, igniting a fire and severely damaging the hull. According to reports, the drones targeted the ship's generator deliberately and left the vessel stranded, sending SOS signals into the night. Drones reportedly continued to circle the ship in the early hours of the 2nd of May, and inquiries into the incident are still ongoing. As yet, no country has claimed responsibility for the attack, nor has any Western country expressed any interest at all in finding the perpetrator of the attack. This is reminiscent of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline attack at the height of the Russo-Ukraine conflict in the international waters of the Baltic Sea. Eerie silence from the powers that be, i.e. the international community. You can find out more about the history of the Freedom Flotilla Coalition, plus their first-hand accounts, news updates, and what you can do to support their cause at freedomflotilla.org. In a shocking but wholly unsurprising update, Israel's security cabinet has now formally approved plans to annex Gaza, a move that would see the forcible displacement of millions of Palestinians from their homes. Reportedly, the Zionist state putting the call out to activate over 30,000 additional reservists, which begs the question of how actually effective this strategy will be, considering that at no point in the last over 580 days have they actually been able to hold any positions in Gaza militarily. And now, at over 18 months from the start of the rampant and brutal abuses of international law, the stated objectives of removing Hamas from operational power, retrieving the hostages, and securing its perceived borders on all fronts, Israel has objectively failed. Though it may continue its wanton brutality against unarmed civilians sleeping in tents, every day its standing in the international community is under scrutiny from every angle. We can see right now in Eurovision there's an open petition from over 70 artists that have signed to not allow Israel to compete in Eurovision, which, I mean, why should it? It's not even in Europe. Its reputation is slowly eroding. The call to activate more reservists only sequesters more working people out of Israel's own sectors that have completely faltered, with a complete construction sector that is stopped for the last 2 years, and a tourism sector that has had a 60% decline in economic activity, both of which signal a greater pattern of decline. Meanwhile, in Gaza itself, the situation continues to worsen. Israeli airstrikes this week targeted a restaurant and a crowded market in Gaza City, killing at least 25 people in the initial blast. The toll continued to rise throughout the day, with more than 63 people confirmed dead, many of them children. The devastation is staggering. This is the harsh reality for Gaza's residents, whose lives are constantly threatened by bombardments and whose basic needs, including food, are weaponized by Israel, whether by the open targeting of the last remaining providers of local food or by the beyond crippling blockade that has seen no humanitarian aid come through crossings in over 60 days. Israel's blockade has condemned millions to a slow death by starvation. Yet even when the Palestinians seek to buy food in crowded markets or eat at restaurants, they are met with airstrikes. Food is a weapon. This is how Israel seeks to impose its will on Gaza, by starving the people into submission. Meanwhile, in the occupied West Bank, Israel has proceeded with its military operations dubbed Operation Iron Wall, the most recent phase of which has been its ongoing assault against Palestinians in the region. Since the operation began, tens of thousands of people have been displaced, the largest forced migration since 1967. Schools have been shut down, students and teachers have been arrested, detained, and even killed. The UN has accused Israel of committing scholasticide, what it deems are a deliberate and systematic attempt to destroy the Palestinian education system. As one displaced student put it to Red Media, "They've taken everything away from me." And in South Lebanon, Israeli forces have launched their most intense bombardment since the ceasefire brokered in November. The Nabatea district was hit particularly hard. And in this period since the ceasefire, over 2,970 ceasefire violations have been committed by the State of Israel since last November. And the bombing in Lebanon is just the latest sign of escalating violence in the region. More than 148 people have been killed in this period in Lebanon, and Israel continues to occupy Lebanese land. This is not just about Gaza, this is about an entire region being reshaped through colonial violence. The repression is not confined to the Middle East, in fact. It bleeds back into the heart of the very empire that enables the violence in the Levantine region. Within the United States regime itself, dissent is also under attack. At Columbia University this week in New York, 75 peaceful pro-Palestine protesters were arrested after occupying a library to demand divestment from Israeli apartheid. These students refused to leave, setting up tents, holding protests, and organizing for change within their institution. And in response, the university called the police, who were only happy to oblige and showed up in a staggering display of state repression. This latest crackdown comes amidst a broader effort to silence criticism of Israel globally. The US regime has now threatened to withhold federal funding from universities that allow students to criticize the Israeli government. This is a direct attack on academic freedom, trying to criminalize dissent, turning campuses into ideological battlegrounds where only one side can be heard. These stories echo with the screams that were muffled by our own local university bodies, adopting without discussion or consent the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism and generating a culture of fear amongst our most prestigious pedagogic institutions, with students and academics that I spoke to, who wish to remain anonymous, saying that they now organize reading and discussion groups in secret for fear of administrative punishment and reprimand. Moving to Syria, the violence continues to spiral. Recently, armed groups affiliated with Hayat Tahrir al-Shams have launched attacks on Druze communities in several locations. Videos have surfaced online showing the severe abuse and humiliation suffered by these communities at the hands of the armed groups. Despite an agreement brokered by the self-appointed state officials and Druze leaders, the violence remains unchecked, and many local residents have begun organizing themselves to protect the city of Suwaida from further sectarian massacres. Adding fuel to the fire, Israel has once again stepped in, this time with a controversial, I'm doing big scare quotes here, humanitarian aid mission. On Saturday, the Israeli army continued their distribution of aid to people in Suwaida. Reports are also emerging that wounded Syrians are being transported to hospitals in Israeli-occupied territories for treatment. This tactic is reminiscent of earlier stages of the Syrian civil war, as well as the Lebanese civil war, where Israel exploited sectarian violence to divide and conquer, making it clear that it is not merely neutral in this conflict. Israel's ongoing intervention continues to exacerbate the already fragile situation within Syria, and the state's efforts to portray itself as a benevolent actor demonstrate only the deep cynicism and hubris of a political class completely bereft of morals. Moving now to West Africa. In Burkina Faso, the struggle for sovereignty is heating up. On April 30th, a coup attempt was thwarted. But instead of generating division and sowing chaos, it sparked mass support for Ibrahim Traoré, the young leader who's made waves across the whole of Africa and indeed the world. People are rising up, not just in Burkina Faso, but across the global south in defense of their rights and against foreign imperialist intervention. This is not just about one coup. This is about a tidal shift in the global order starting from humble ripples, a global south rising, taking to the streets and demanding change. Meanwhile, in Sudan, the war rages on, and the International Court of Justice has dismissed Sudan's case against the UAE. Sudan had accused the UAE of complicity in the ongoing atrocities committed by the Rapid Support Forces in West Darfur. Despite credible reports from UN experts, the ICJ ruled the case out of its jurisdiction, leaving Sudan with no legal recourse. The RSF's attacks continue, including recent drone strikes on Port Sudan, which had previously been recognized as a safe zone, and the UAE's role in fueling this conflict is now widely recognized, yet justice remains elusive. Hot off the press of Vijay Prashad's Tricontinental Institute of Social Research and subsidiary Global South Insights, they've recently published a dossier on the effects of US sanctions on Venezuela. As they continue to ravage the country, the report reveals that Venezuela has lost over $226 billion in oil revenue from 2017 to 2024. Due to the US regime's sanctions. This is the equivalent of 213% of the country's entire GDP, a staggering economic blow meant to break the back of Venezuela's people. These sanctions have inflicted immense suffering, with Venezuela losing $77 million every single day as a result of the economic blockade. We will be talking to Vijay this coming week, and I look forward to sharing our conversations with you as we explore what he terms as a new mood in the global south and what that means as our world struggles to define itself out of its present contradictions. Moving now to Eastern Europe. In Romania, far-right politics is gaining ground. On Sunday, George Simion, the leader of Romania's ultra-nationalist AUR party, won 40.5% of the vote in the first round of presidential elections. Simion is a self-proclaimed ally of Trump and has expressed admiration for Hungary's Viktor Orban. His platform includes banning same-sex marriage, eliminating Holocaust education, cutting military aid to Ukraine, and purging Europe of what he calls neo-Marxist madness. He has also met with Israeli officials, endorsing the settlement expansions in the West Bank, This is part of a larger global trend where far-right leaders are building ties to strengthen their oppressive political agendas amongst the decaying carcass of the global liberal project. The fascists have been here for a while. It is only that the mask has now completely slipped off and the niceties have been dispensed with. This week, in better news, sort of, has marked the 80th anniversary of the Red Army's victory over Nazi Germany. And in this time, since the illegal dismantling of the Soviet Union, almost 3,000 Soviet-era monuments have been destroyed as decommunization efforts sweeping through Eastern Europe have continued. Not content with just the physical structures, but wanting to attack memory itself, the German regime this week, just days before celebrations for the 80th anniversary, opted to ban all displays of communist symbols, magazine, and indeed playing anti-fascist songs. This is not simply historical revisionism. This is its erasure. An attempt to rewrite history by erasing the very people who defeated Hitler and the Nazis. While our government here legislates using a now widely purportedly anti-Semitic caravan hoax, in the real world, the attack is on the actual living memory of those who fought and died to defend humanity, human rights, and values. Speaking of our government, the recent federal election results from last week delivered to Labour what they're deeming a thumping win. But to view this as anything but a complete failure of the Greens to galvanise the energy in the hearts and minds of the people who have been on the streets for years now is paramount. There's nothing more that can be said. We can't view this as a little dopamine hit that with Dutton losing his seat or whatever. None of that really matters. There is a complete failing of the political class to recognize what the people on the street wants, whether it's workers' rights, whether it's Indigenous First Nations justice, or a stop to our government's support in the brutal killings in Palestine. This is a government that for the last 18 months has slyly weaseled its way out of saying and maybe not saying that it's continuing its arms trade with Israel through third parties and blah, blah, blah. But maybe most egregiously, for a party that has historically come from within the labor movement, I know it's long ago, but to decree in their leader's first speech that the main priority of the newly instated government is to increase production. Not content with the growing social ruptures, the human rights abuses being administered to kids in the Northern Territory where they are being imprisoned, and the very real war crimes that our tax dollars have been committed, their interest is to make everyone work more. Instead, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has once again taken a controversial diplomatic stand. Starting his international tour, or he will start his international tour, he said, by meeting with Indonesian General Prabowo Subianto, a man with a brutal history tied to mass killings in anti-communist purges under the Suharto regime. Albanese, referring to Prabowo as a good friend, has upset many with his cozying up to such a figure who has overseen the continuing campaign to repress Indonesia's own citizens, own labor union movements who are protesting against suffocating so-called security legislations, but also has overseen the ongoing colonial violence in West Papua. This really does beg the question, how does a self-proclaimed progressive government reconcile these types of alliances? Albanese's stance on arming Israel, befriending war criminals from Prabowo to Modi, and continuing controversial defense deals in AUKUS is a growing concern for me, for everyone that I talk to. I'll close by quoting a recent Tricontinental Institute of Social Research newsletter where Prashad quotes Sudirman, who was the General Secretary of the Communist Party of Indonesia and the only PKI leader to be put on trial following the 30th September movement in 1965, where millions of communists were killed. He was sentenced to death and executed. This is Sudirman. This is his poem I'm quoting now. The ocean adjoins Mount Krakatau. Mount Krakatau adjoins the ocean. The ocean may not run dry, though the hurricane roars. Krakatau does not bend, though the typhoon rages. The ocean is the people. Krakatau is the party. The two always close together. The two adjoining one another. The ocean adjoins Mount Krakatau. Mount Krakatau adjoins the ocean. Quoting Prashad now, it is inescapable, Sudirman wrote from the depths of a Jakarta military prison from which he knew he could not escape, that the people will not tolerate the contradictions of imperialism and capitalism, and that they will eventually form their own organizations, and that these organizations, enveloped in a new spirit, will rise and transcend the conditions of our time. Those moments will arise, the new mood developing into a new spirit. I'll go now to a song by Shabjeet called Asad, and then we'll hear from the Sydney Palestine rallies that comrade Vivian Langford has recorded once again. Shabjeet now.